So what happened in the end part of chapter 19? What did we study last week? Yeah.
Merchants were driven out of the temple at the
Okay.
end.
The cleansing of the temple, the second time in scripture that we know that Jesus did that, but he did it on the other two occasions he was there for the Passover. We do know that in John 2. Did it in here in Luke 19. John 2 is at the beginning of the ministry. Luke 19 is at the end. And it's the same one that's also recorded in Matthew, the cleansing of the temple. But the notable occasion is the triumphal entry. And I think about that with you a little bit. The triumphal entry, I discovered something last week that at least it impacted me in a way that I hadn't seen before. And that is that for almost a mile, the slopes of Mount Olivet to the temple is 3/4, 7/8 of a mile. And for that distance, the people were thronging Jesus. And how many people were there? In your mind, there's no record of it, but if you got him being escorted in front and in back, this massive distance, it had to be a large, and we saw how that even in Jericho, Zacchaeus had to get up in a tree on the parade route just to be able to see Jesus. That's how popular he is with the masses at this time. And so he is coming in to the city. He cast he cleansed the temple, verse 45. He entered the temple, began to cast out those who were selling, saying to them, "It is written, and my Father's house shall be a house of prayer, but you have made it a robber's." We didn't expand upon that last week. We did not flesh it out. Could you imagine the challenges that that would be, single-handedly rousting all of the Michael, you mentioned how that you had gone to the flea market in Packwood and how massive that was. Suppose that you decided that that was corruption there, and you were just going to single-handedly oust them all. Can you picture the child doing that? And yet that's probably pales compared to what Jesus had as far as the size and the area that was covered and the amount of money that was taken in. This was a massive undertaking, and he did it. He just chased them all out. Think with me about how do I want to say this? This would be a very dividing type of activity. Would on the one hand, there would be some that would be applauding Jesus. It's about time somebody took action. On the other hand, there would be some who would be resisting Jesus. And so we're having like the dividing of the Red Sea. A division is taking place here in the people. This is the last weeks of life. Now, I'm going to toss something in here. See, I'm going to try to do it in a way that it makes sense. In my head, it does. But we have here in Luke 19 the triumphal entry. Where is the triumphal entry in the book of John? It's chapter 12. Okay, in chapter 12. What did Jesus do in John in chapter 11? Who came forth? Who is the fourth guy in that tomb? Lazarus come forth. Well, that was spectacular, but not everybody believed as a result of what Jesus did. Some of the people went and ratted Jesus out to the authority. You remember what the authorities said? We need to kill him so that we don't lose our nation to the Romans. Okay, this was just before his triumphal entry. that we read about there in John 12. And so here now we have the triumphal entry, and we have this great mass of people that are following with Jesus. And here on one of the days, we're going to read now 1 through 8 of chapter 20. And it came about on one of the days, while he was teaching the people in the temple, not necessarily the next day or the first one of the days, but he only had a few, like five or six, five, maybe four or five, before they put him to death. And so one of those days, he was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, that the chief priest and the scribes with the elders confronted him, and they spoke, saying to him, "Tell us by what authority you're doing these things, or who is the one who gave you this authority?" And he answered and said to them, "I shall also ask you a question, and you tell me. Was the baptism of John from heaven or from men?" And they reasoned among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, we will say, why did you not believe him? But if we say from men, all the people will stone us to death, for they are convinced that John was a prophet." And they answered him that they did not know from where. And Jesus said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I am doing these things." Okay, so good evening, gentle people. So we just read 1 through 8 of chapter 20, where Jesus is accosted. Do you notice? Well, first of all, you got the sense, did you get the sense that there were enough people present that it intimidated the authorities? If we say of men, they'll stone us. There was enough impact in the crowd to intimidate, to cause these guys to be afraid to say what they really thought. But did you also notice, look in verse 1, it says the chief priest and the scribes along with the elders. What picture is formulating in your mind with that?
This is all the authorities.
This is an en masse approach. This is a rather aggressive approach. The authorities. We're going to come clean up this act here in the temple. I mean, you guys, you kicked our guys out the other day, and now look what you're doing. You're teaching. And so this was not just one or two guys escorting Jesus out. This was a mass approach of leading men. Very intimidating, you would think. And I suppose that's why they did it that way, to intimidate Jesus. And so they said, "Tell us, give us your authority." First of all, it says he was preaching the gospel. What was he preaching? He's preaching the gospel, or telling the good news. What was the good news? The king is here. Every promise that the prophets made to our fathers is about to be fulfilled.
Yep.
When we talk about preaching the gospel, we talk about death, burial, resurrection, and we should, because that's what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, the gospel, that he died and was buried and raised again on the third day. But it hadn't happened here, and so Jesus is preaching something that hadn't happened. No, it's the good news. All of this is wrapped up in God keeping his promises that he made to Israel, that I am going to raise you back up from the death that you are in to be alive to me again. I'm going to take you back for my people. I'll adopt you into my family. I'm going to do all this, and I'm going to set a king over you, a king that won't be like the kings that led you into corruption. I'm going to set a high priest over you, a high priest not like the ones that were in it for themselves. I am going to give you a good shepherd. All of those promises Jesus is there telling the people the gospel, the good news. That's when these
Let's look
guys
at that.
came up
Where does it
and
go? Where does it go?
accosted him.
Goes in the cabinet?
Somebody needs to turn on their.
Michael?
Yeah, I was just going to say that every time that he, even like with John the Baptist, John the Baptist asked him, "Are you the one?" He was quoting the scriptures of the prophecies that were said about him, about the blind seeing and everything. He was giving them the evidence for them to make the conclusion of him being the Messiah.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. Now it says that they said to him, this entourage of authority said to him, "By what authority are you doing these things, and who gave you permission to do things?" Is this proper to accost Jesus, Son of God, in the temple like that? What do you think?
Yeah, they are the authority.
Yeah, they're expected to.
You did not.
Well, let me say it this way. In Deuteronomy 13, Moses said, if somebody rises up and tries to draw you away, you're to follow God and take care of that guy. So they could use that, because to say that Jesus was leading the people astray, they could use Deuteronomy 13 to execute him. So they had that from God, easily misused, obviously. Because Jesus wasn't misleading the people. He was telling them that all the promises God made were about to come true. He was leading them back to have been all alone. But they could use that. But there's also the thing Scott said. Do you remember when Paul of Tarsus ran out of victims in Jerusalem and wanted to go to Damascus? Acts 9. What did he have in his hand? A written letter, a writ signed by the high priest that gave him permission to enter the synagogues in Damascus and roust out these Christians. So what is this era of authority, authoritarian, totalitarianism almost, we rule, you follow. Who gave you this authority? Tell me, Rabbi, signed permit slip. If I were to try to put a booth in the farmer's market over here, that not this a little early in the season for it, but I would probably have to have some kind of slip to do that, a booth authorization from somebody to do that. I can't just go in and throw up my tent and say I'm selling stuff because they want their cut of the money. They want their rent and they want their share, and so who gave you authority to stand up here and preach? And who is the one that gave you? Jesus said, "I'm going to ask you a question too. I'm going to ask you a question, and you tell me. If you tell me, and then I'll tell you." So he said, "The baptism of John, was it from heaven or from men?" I mean, that's a fairly simple question, isn't it? John was out there for a year and a half preaching baptism, and Jesus was preaching the same baptism for 3 years with a 6 month overlap. John started a year, half a year before Jesus, and was executed a year into Jesus. And for 2 more years, Jesus was preaching the baptism. Did that come from heaven or did that come from man? What does he mean by that question? What does Jesus mean by that question? Did it come from heaven? Means what?
It's basically where did John started?
Yeah, but the question, did it come from heaven?
Thank you, by God.
Is it sanctioned by God? Where did it come from, man? Did did I just make that up? Did John just make that up? Did John, a freelancer, is he a renegade? Is he going off on his own? Tell me. And so they noodle on it. Now, when you have two difficult choices, if we say from heaven or say from man, they were in dilemma. Dilemma, okay? Now, here's the thing about Jesus. That if we say from heaven, why didn't you believe it? Oh, and, earlier in Luke, chapter 7, at verse 30, it says, they rejected God's counsel against themselves by not being baptized with John's baptism. They rejected it. Okay, so we know that they rejected it. Here, he'll say, why didn't you do it? If you say it's from heaven, why don't you do it? I suppose that we could make some object lessons on that right there, couldn't we? If we think this came down from God, like Jesus said in Luke 6, verse 46, why do you call me Lord, Lord? Don't do what I say. If it came from God, do it. Okay? If we say it came from God, he'll say, why didn't you do it? But the other horn of the dilemma, if we say it's from man, we fear the people that they will stone us, for they have become persuaded. They are convinced. They have become persuaded that John is a prophet. So which one are we going to say? We get ourselves, well, why didn't you do what he said? Or get ourselves, we could lose our life, certainly lose our following. So they said, we don't know. Now, in Matthew 11, verses 9 through 14, Jesus said, what did you go out in the wilderness to see? You know, that story. If he said in this 9 through 14, Matthew 11, 9 through 14, he said in verse 14, if you're willing to receive it, John was the Elijah who was to come. So that's one of those promises that was being fulfilled. Okay? And so the people take him for a prophet. So Jesus, they answered Jesus, we don't know from where. So here are three answers. Yeah, it's from heaven. Why didn't you do it? It's from man. We're afraid of the people. So we'll say, we don't know. Look what they did to themselves. This is the third horn of the dilemma. As soon as they said, we don't know, what did they do to themselves? Pardon? You remember what Jesus said to Nicodemus? Are you a teacher and you don't understand these things?
Even the guys that are supposed to know it all.
Yeah, they disqualify themselves as being capable to teach.
Their power was
powerless. And so I just am a very simple question. Just completely eviscerated these guys. Exposed their emptiness, exposed their shallowness, exposed their selfishness, their self-aggrandizement, all exposed. They weren't in it for the people, they were in it for themselves. And then when they said, we don't know, why are you the teacher if you don't know? And so Jesus said that I'm not going to tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. Now, why not? Why not tell them? Think about it. There's probably several answers.
That's almost,
that's my line.
Disrespect, lack of respect, or just really just, they're putting the last nail in. You're not even worth answering them.
Yeah, right. You haven't earned an answer. You don't deserve an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's probably the most significant one. But think about if Jesus engaged on their playing field, started answering their questions. That puts them in charge of the dialogue. You can't answer a simple question, and I am not able to answer yours. Yeah, yeah. And so I'm not going to tell you. You don't need to. It's also implying you have no dominion in this case. You have no standing in whether or not I'm going to stand here and teach. It's my Father's house, not yours. You have no authority to kick me out. I'm going to tell you. I don't need to tell you. All of those things. So there's Roger. That. There.
Can you hear me all right?
Michael.
Yeah, I just wanted to say is that there is definitely a power struggle going on here that they can see by the amount of people that are being by this prophet or this teacher that is among them, that they're losing control of, you know, of the power over the people, which they have been displaying for so long.
Yeah, and it get worse, Michael. It's going to get worse. But that's exactly what's going on. They can feel, they can sense their grip loosening. It's like trying to get a grip when you got corn huskers all over your hands. It's slippery as tar as can be. And so, yeah, they're feeling it slipping away. How do they feel that? If you were one of them, how would you feel? Threatened, desperate, would you use the word angry? Enraged? Okay, threatened, angry, or enraged, desperate. How would you like to meet somebody like that in the back alley? Okay, these guys still have a lot of clout. They still have control over the court system, and they still have the ear of the Romans. They've still got a lot of clout. Jesus is just has defanged them with the public. Okay. Now, so why are you doing? Who gave you a right to do this? Well, tell me about the baptism of John. Oh, we don't know. Well, then I'm not going to tell you. That's it. You see that, Alan? That's just it. I'm not going to tell you. But something else. And so consider that what he's about to tell them, this parable. He's not moved on. He's still got these. He's still teaching the people, but he's got the entourage of authority right there in front of him. Well, yeah, and that he's going to look them square in the eye and tell them these things. Okay, so he began to speak this parable. He began to speak this parable to the people. A certain man planted a vineyard and rented it out to vine growers, to gardeners, and went on a journey for a long time. And at the time, harvest time, the proper time, literally the appropriate or the proper, the ripe or the fixed time, set time, he sent a slave to the vine growers in order that they might give him of the produce of the vineyard. But vine growers beat him and sent him away empty-handed. He proceeded to send another, and they beat him also and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. The owner of the vineyard is getting nothing back from his vineyard. And he proceeded to send a third. This one also they wounded and cast. And the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him." But the vipers saw him. When they saw him, they reasoned with one another, saying, "This is the heir. Let's kill him, that the inheritance might be ours." And they cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. What therefore will the owner of the vineyard do to them? I'm going to stop there at that question, the scenario. There's nothing unusual about a landowner renting out his property. When I lived in Indiana, landowners would lease the field to the guys, the farmers. Generally, the crops were corn or soybeans or wheat. Corn, soybeans, and they'd rotate them. And the rental or the lease would be part of the whatever the crop was. To they then the landowner, not part of the crop, but the proceeds from the crop, and the farmer would get the money. Actually, it worked like this. The landowner had a set fee. This is what the lease is year by year. And the farmer would try to make a sufficient on his effort to pay for his fee, for his time, pay off the lease, the profit. And so this was typical then for a field, vineyard, orchard, whatever it was, be rented out to somebody else to work it, to drop off of it, and then give some of the crop to the one who owns the property. That's the picture, okay? It would be very understandable. Yeah, the owner of the field ought to get something from there. And so he began to speak this parable. Why did he speak this parable? Is there any connection with what we just saw? The scribes and the chief priests and the elders, the current leaders of the people, okay, who were expected to be in the parable, the certain man, that'd be God, okay? What is the Israel? Let me take you over to Isaiah 5. Just have yes. In your mind, turn to Isaiah 5 or attend to this. Is very, very, very short reading. It's a very, very, very fine reading. Isaiah 5, beginning at verse 1. Let me sing now for my well-beloved a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. Now my well-beloved is God. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill, and he dug it all around, removed its stones, planted it with the choicest vine, and he built a tower in the middle of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. Then he expected good. He expected to produce grapes, but it produced worthless ones. Now, it's a little bit different picture. What he got from the vineyard was worthless grapes instead of good grapes, but the picture is still, I have a vineyard. You remember what Jesus said over in the book of John? I am the vine, and you are the branches. So he's going back to the vineyard again. And so, and we're going to see that continue here in Luke. But here's this vineyard. Now, down in, where is it? In verse 7, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. And the grapes that he was expecting, he looked for justice and for righteousness. That's what he looked for. That's the fruit that he was trying to extract from his vineyard. And that would have been the efforts of the teachers to keep the people following with God and developing and culturing the habits of God. That's there in Isaiah 5. The vineyard is the house of Israel. Okay? And so here, then back in Luke 20, as we see in verse 9, that he had a vineyard. Well, there is a very definite connection between that and Isaiah 5. Okay? He had a vineyard. He rented the vine growers that would be the priesthood mainly. And the priesthood extracted their living how? How did the priests didn't have a territorial property. They had a city here and a city there. But mainly, they were fed by what? Sacrifice. The tithes and the sacrifices. That's how they were supported, okay? And so they were supported by the work that they're doing spiritually. And that's the picture Jesus is painting here. That they're working the vineyard, and God is expecting produce to come from that vineyard, but he's not getting it. In fact, what were they doing to the prophets? As he sent prophets to them to straighten out the way we think of a prophet as a future teller, right? Primarily, the prophets were scolders. This is what you're doing, and this is what you promised to do, what Moses said to do. Primarily, they were trying to reform Israel's attitudes so they wouldn't be taken off into captivity. Knowing that they're into captivity, every once in a while, the prophet would predict about how God would rescue them with Messiah. But mainly, it was to turn their hearts back to God through the preaching of the prophets, to get that produce for God. You see the point I'm making? That as Israel as a nation would start to veer off from the path of God. I'm glad the United States isn't doing that, but as when Israel, okay, I went over everybody's head, almost nobody's head. But as Israel would start to slide away, God would raise up prophets to come and talk to them about it. Jeremiah said frequently that God rose up early to send prophets. He tried to nip it in the bud. Okay, and so the point was to get this justice and righteousness back into the hearts of the people. But what would they do to the prophets? What did they do to Jeremiah? Why do we call Jeremiah the weeping prophet? His work did not turn them around. 50 years of preaching and could not avert Babylonian destruction and captivity. But before Babylon destroyed them, what did they do to Jeremiah? They didn't kill him. They never did kill him. They tried to. God kept them from killing, but they threw him in a pit, sunk up to his armpits in mud. It's just, they were horrible. And some of the prophets they did kill. Jewish tradition has the most spectacular prophet. Well, I can't say that because there are several really outstanding prophets. Daniel, Isaiah are two of my favorites. But the Jewish tradition has it that in his old age, Manasseh, king of Israel, had old man Isaiah, stuffed into a log and then sawn in half. Okay? Some, they killed him. They abused him. They mistreated him. They didn't respond, I guess is the point I'm getting. And so, what am I going to do? I want fruit of righteousness and justice from this people. That's what I want from this people. What am I going to do? I know. I'll send my son. If I send my son, they'll respect him because that's the son of a landowner. They'll respect him. But they saw him, verse 14, seeing him, the gardeners reasoned, the vineyard owners, the gardeners, reasoned with one another, saying, this is the heir. If we kill him, the inheritance will become ours. Okay, now I mentioned John 11, where Jesus had raised Lazarus and some of the Jews went to the council and ratted them out. And here's what they said. John 11, I'm going to start verse 7. Therefore, the chiefs and the Pharisees convened a council when they heard that Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead. They convened a council and were saying, what are we doing? In other words, what steps can we take? For this man is performing many signs. Alan, just by way of side note, this was an admission by the enemies of Jesus. It's not just the friends of Jesus that talk about his miracles. Even the enemies admit the signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. We will lose control. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said, you know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation should not perish. If we just put him to death, then the Romans won't come in and destroy our city. You know, what's interesting about that, Andy, it's over in 1 Thessalonians 2. The reason God destroyed Jerusalem to a final end was because they put his son to death. And they're saying here, if we put this guy to death, then we won't lose our city. You know, just totally backwards thing. But that gives you an idea. So if we kill him, the inheritance will be ours. We will get to continue to rule this place and run this place. So, and casting him outside the vineyard, throwing him out of the vineyard, they kill him. What's the owner going to do? Now think about it. They cast him out of the vineyard. And what in the parable, I mean, as you apply the parable, what happened? Cast him out of the vineyard.
Took him outside the city.
Yeah, they did, but I think there's more involved than that. Do you remember the blind man in John 9? When he admitted that it was Jesus that gave him sight, they put him out. They excommunicated him. No longer part of the people of God. So, yeah, they did take him outside the city, and they crucified him outside the city. And so on that point, I want you to read with me from Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 12, actually it's verse chapter 13. Chapter 13 says in verse 12, just like the bodies of the animals that were sacrificed for sin had to be taken outside the camp, he says, therefore Jesus also, verse 12, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Hence, let us go out to him outside the camp. Now, what the Hebrews writer was then calling for what to happen? Wasn't he calling for the Jewish Christians to make a complete break from Judaism? Let's go outside with him. He got cut off from Judaism. We will too. We'll no longer be part of this cultus. Temple means nothing to us. Priesthood means nothing to us. We've got Jesus. Okay, so here in Luke 20, it says they cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. And so I want you to connect Hebrews 13, verses 12 and 13 with that thought. And the way we just did, not just go outside the city gates, but Jesus went left without them and was no longer part of the old covenant Israel. He left it. He left and was separated from it and died to it. He says, you need to guys need to do the same. Okay, any thoughts? Yeah, I need to wet my whistle. All right. Verse 15 then, or 16. Jesus, at end of verse 15, says, what therefore will the owner of the vineyard do? Now, I want us to reestablish what the owner, he's talking about God, and the vineyard, he's talking about the nation of Israel. These guys knew that. I mean, we had to work to put it together, but they knew what Jesus was talking about. They knew what God's vineyard was. They knew who was in charge of the crop in, and they knew, say, and so six, Jesus gave an answer. If you read over in Matthew, he let them answer. But Luke just gave the answer. I want to do that, by the way. Just compare Matthew 21 and Mark 12 and Luke 20. The story is in all three of those places. Be interesting. We're not going to do that. But here he says in verse 16, the answer, he will come and destroy those vine growers and will give you to others. And when they said, may it never be. But he looked at them. He looked them square in the eye. He says, haven't you ever read? Haven't you ever read what was written? The stone which the builders rejected became the chief. You never read that? It's like Jesus is amazed. I'm not going to tell you because you say you don't know. But he knew they knew. They just weren't willing to say it. But here, have you never read, implies that they should, if they're genuine, and I got to say this with all seriousness for all of us. It's one thing to read, to know what you've read. You know, read, okay, I read that. I really like that story. It's another thing to dive in and say, what was he trying to tell me? And over in Psalm 18, that's where this is. Let's just go over there for a minute. There's more than just this really nice little thing that's said. And it is a really nice little thing that's said. And it's, you'll find it on plaques everywhere. I think we might even have it on our wall here somewhere. Psalm 118. And I'm going to start at 19, verse 19. Open to me the righteousness. I shall enter through them. I shall give thanks to Yahweh. This is the gate of Yahweh. The righteous will enter through it. I'll give thanks to you, for you have answered me, and you have become my salvation. So there's this wonderful picture of getting to go into the gate to something that God has made that is a fortress or an area of salvation. Then he said in verse 22, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief corner.
Right.
I stop a noodle on that one right there. The stone which the builders did. Who are the builders?
The leaders.
The spiritual leaders. In every generation, they had the job of building in the hearts of people what God wanted for them and from them. And so God had been promising, this is David writing this, and so God had been promising that from the lineage of David, one would rise up to rescue God's people. And you can go all the way back to the garden in Genesis 3:15. The seed of woman would crush the killing serpent. And so a seed would come and crush the killing serpent. It's a promise. It was like a beautiful golden thread that goes through the entire Old Testament, ending up at the cross of Jesus. That there was going to be this one that would crush. Okay, here the picture is he's going to be the one that becomes the foundation of God's temple. And who are the builders? The spiritual leaders. And so when God came and said, build my temple on this stone, this cut perfect stone. Alan, you do some kind of construction work. I'm not sure totally, but I suspect that you know what a level is for in a plumb bob. Yeah, you want it to be square. You want it to be perpendicular. They didn't have what we would call levels. I'm sure they did. And you can make a water level, dig a ditch and make a water level, you know. But a cornerstone was perfectly cut with right angles so that every dimension of whatever you built would be taken from that. Whether it's the floor or this side wall or this side wall, it would be taken from that stone. God gave Israel a cornerstone upon which to build their temple. It was Jesus. The builder says, if we let him go on like this, we're going to lose our nation. So let's kill him. Jesus said, don't you know what's written in the scriptures? When they said, when he told them, vineyard is going to be taken from you. They understood that they were the ones and given to somebody else. They said, may it never be. He said, haven't you read? You reject the stone. It's going to become the stone anyway. You reject the cornerstone that God gave you. He's not going to let it go to the junk pile. So this is the stone I'm going to build my temple with. You builders, you don't want that stone? You're fired. I'll get someone who will do that. Now here's the exciting, to me it's exciting. Peter, the night Jesus was crucified, said, I'll never forsake, I'll never deny you. Servant girl come up to him. says, weren't you one of them? And he cursed and swore. He said, no, I'm not. And then the rooster crowed, and Peter just wept. That fellow who was kowtowed by a servant girl, not too many months later, said this in Acts 4. This is his second sermon. He's on trial. His second sermon was in chapter 3. He's on trial for preaching it. And he says in verse 9, on trial, Acts 4, 9, we're on trial today for a benefit done to a sick man as to how this man has been made well. Let it be known to you and to all the people that by the name of Jesus Christ the Nazarene, whom you crucified, whom God raised from the dead, by this, this man stands before you in good health. I mean, they couldn't deny the fact that the guy was there. And in fact, they said so in verse 14, seeing the guy, they had nothing to say in reply. And then a little bit later, he says, a noteworthy miracle has been done. It's obvious to everybody. They can't deny what Peter is saying here. He says, by this, this man's here. Now watch verse 11, Alan. He is the stone which was rejected by you, the builders, which became the very corner. You know, what's interesting to me about that, Rachel? He's citing Psalm 118. But Psalm 118 says the stone which was rejected by the builders became the chief corner. Peter, in quoting this, says stone which was rejected by you, the builders. He nailed a specific time that the psalm was talking about. Okay, let me keep reading in the book of Psalm now. That was 22. 23, this is the Lord's doing. He's going to make a temple, whether or not the builders are participating. It is marvelous in our eyes. This is the day which the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Now you see how that's not just some kind of generic statement about it's a great day today. He's talking about the day that the cornerstone was laid. This is the day. Let's rejoice and be glad in that day. It's a beautiful day. But here, Jesus, in back in Luke now, Luke 20, Jesus looked them. It's just, Linda, just, it's amazing. He looked them square in the eye. This mass of leaders that could have and should have been intimidating, he just stood there and looked them in the eye and said, the stone that was, which the builders rejected, this has become the chief corner. Everyone who falls on the stone will be broken to pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like dust. Now, I translated that just a tad differently, because you got two things. You got the stone on the people, and you got the people falling on the stone. Any thoughts? The people falling on the stone is the first one.
That's what the leaders.
You ever been tripped up by something? Tripped up. If this concept of me being the chief cornerstone causes you to trip up, you're going to be squashed. Okay? But there's also, I'm noodling on this idea. You tell me whether it makes any sense. I go back to David, certain places in David, and it says in their battles, and he fell on him. It means he took him in battle. He laid hands on him and fell on him. And it might mean that he was put to death. It might mean he was captured. And so I don't know. Is Jesus the same thing twice, just differently? If you trip over the stone, you're going to be squashed. If the stone falls on you, and you're going to be squashed still. But the word cast to the wind is literally winnowed. You'll be winnowed. And I thought Matthew 3, where John the Baptist says his winnowing fork is in his hand with a winnowing fork. You know what a winnowing fork is? Yeah, it's you got the grain and the chaff mixed up together, and they take a winnowing fork and It's kind of like a big a manure spreader, almost a manure fork, a big broad, maybe kind of like a yard rake, big broad, and so that you could get a big bunch of this, toss it up in the wind, the chaff would blow away, and the grain would fall back and be harvested. So be winnowed. If I'm, and so here's you got the two thoughts. The one thought is. In the first case, it's always the same. If you trip over the rock, you're going to be squashed. But if the rock lays hands on you, either you're going to be squashed again, so he's saying the same thing twice, or the rock lays hand on you, you'll be winnowed. And that could be a good thing for you, to be winnowed. So I'm going to leave it up to you to decide what Jesus is talking about here. But we have this picture of Jesus being accosted while he's teaching people good news, challenged. Where do you get the right to tell these people that? What about the baptism of John? We come from God or from man? From heaven or from man? We don't know, but I'm not going to tell you. But I am going to tell you this. I'm going to tell you about the landowner who had a vineyard who gave it out to the vineyard keepers, who were not willing to give what he was looking for from his vineyard. What's he going to do to those vineyard keepers, especially if they kill his son? He's going to take the vineyard away from them. Guys, see, circle back now. You guys are about to lose control that you're so desperately trying to hold on to. You're about to lose control. What do you suppose that does to them? Look at verse 19. And the scribes and the chief priests tried to lay hands on him that very hour. And they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke this parable against them. We want to get rid of this, but we're afraid of the people. Why would they be afraid of the people?
Insurrection.
Insurrection, that's a good word. Did you say insurrection or resurrection?
Yeah. Insurrection first.
Yeah. These people are finally hearing what their heart had been yearning for and that the leaders had withheld from them.
I mean, the conclusion that they've been being abused too.
Oh, without question. You remember the picture in Ezekiel of the sheep that muddied the water and fouled the food and fleece the sheep. Well, if you're a sheep in that situation, how do you feel? Abused, maltreated or malnourished and vulnerable and helpless and defenseless and without a way out. Along comes this guy and says, you know, you guys are about going down. And God's going to give control of his people over to somebody else. Oh, man, we've got to do something about that guy. But they couldn't because they feared the people because they were hearing what they wanted to hear. But, Alan, what I was referring to a minute ago is Ezekiel 34. Let me read it a little bit here. Verse 2, Ezekiel 34, 2. Now, understand, when I use the word shepherds of Israel, we're talking about both the spiritual leaders and civil leaders. Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to those shepherds, thus says the Lord Yahweh, woe, shepherds of Israel, who have been feeding themselves. Should not the shepherds feed? You eat the fat and clothe yourselves with the wool. You slaughter the fat without feeding them. Those who are sickly, you have not strengthened. The diseased, you have not healed. The broken you have not bound up, the scattered you have not brought back, nor have you sought for the lost, but with force and severity you have dominated them, and they were scattered for lack of a shepherd. And you go on, and God says, I am going to raise up a shepherd for them, David, my son, Jesus. And so how would the flock feel being abused like that? And so here comes Jesus saying, we're taking it away from you and giving it to somebody else. And they might say, yay, we have a realm change, a dominion change. And the people were, so they wanted to lay hands on Jesus, but they couldn't. Now, I'm going to let you in on a little secret as we close here. They wanted to lay hands on Jesus any time other than the day of the feast. They didn't want to do it on the day of the feast. You know when they did it? On the day of the feast. Who was in control? Not their desires, but his. He had to be crucified on the Passover. He was God's Passover lamb. All right, any thoughts, questions, comments, objections, rebuttal, anything?
Rod?
All right, next week. Yeah, Michael?
I was just going to say that that's an important motif that is carried throughout the Old Testament and into the New, that of Christ being his Passover lamb is very important to the law, to fulfill the law, as well as when John the Baptist, behold the Lamb of God, you know, it's very characteristic.
Yeah. Right. Now, that was an idea that was introduced not from the text, but in our comments about the text. The picture here is the cornerstone or the vineyard. See, those, the God is taking away the vineyard, which was to produce fruit for him, from those who were just ravaging it and taking advantage of it. He is going to set his cornerstone that the builders rejected. So what are you going to do with a reject when the builders reject your prized stone? You're going to reject the builders. And so they, both of these, they can see, like Belshazzar, they can see the handwriting on the wall. That was for you, Devin. Devin and I are going through the book of Daniel together. All right, any other thoughts?